Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, CBS News on April 14th says, quote, "We're following new violence in the Middle East. Israeli strikes hit a major hospital in northern Gaza. At least 21 people were reportedly killed. The emergency room is badly damaged. Israel accused Hamas of using the hospital to hide its fighters." Meanwhile, Houthi militants in Yemen said they fired two ballistic missiles at Israel. The Israeli military initially said two missiles were launched and one was intercepted, but later said only one missile had been fired, close quote. There's information in there if you can parse it, but the takeaway for most will be that framing, violence in the Middle East, which suggests that whatever happened today is just the latest round in a perennial battle between warring parties. And you and I have no role except that of sad bystander. When it comes to Yemen, elite media's repeat reference to Iran-backed Houthi rebels not only obscures the current fighting's political origins and recent timeline, it erases the Yemeni people who are paying the price.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I've been coming here since 8 a.m. to the Tikuya soup kitchen for food to alleviate our hunger and be able to stand up. We are suffering from famine, real famine. I have not eaten anything since this morning. I cannot speak because of hunger.
As Palestinians starve to death in Gaza, Israel's calling up tens of thousands of reservists to expand its war and reoccupy the Gaza Strip. We'll speak to the Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha. He left Gaza with his family in December of 2023. On Monday, he won a Pulitzer Prize. He's now at Syracuse University. We'll also speak to a pediatric nurse just back from Gaza. But first, President Trump spoke at a $1.5 million a plate crypto fundraiser last night, as Senator Elizabeth Warren's calling for a federal probe over a new $2 billion Abu Dhabi-backed deal using Trump's crypto coin.
So here's the kicker. Binance and the foreign investment firm are going to use Donald Trump's stablecoin to finance their transaction, essentially giving Trump a cut of that $2 billion deal. Boy, looks like corruption, smells like corruption.
We'll speak with crypto researcher Molly White. Her recent piece, Trump's Newest Grift: Building a Cryptocurrency Empire While Destroying Its Regulators. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yemen's Houthi movement says four people were killed and nearly 40 others wounded Monday after Israel bombed a cement factory and a port in the Red Sea city of Hodeidah. They were Israel's first strikes on Yemen in months, coming a day after Houthis fired a missile that struck Israel's Ben-Gurion airport and amidst near-daily U.S. attacks on Yemen. Separately, Israel bombed Lebanon's Bekaa Valley and the Sharifa municipality, targeting what it said were Hezbollah sites. The attacks are another violation of Israel's November 2024 ceasefire with Lebanon. Israeli strikes on Gaza have killed at least 11 Palestinians so far today, with deadly attacks reported in Khan Yunis, Beit Lahia, and Gaza City. The strikes follow Israeli attacks that killed 54 Palestinians on Monday. And as the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, reported some 66,000 children in Gaza are suffering severe malnutrition due to Israel's total blockade of food and aid, now in its ninth week. Some Palestinians have resorted to eating turtle meat, grass, or rotten or expired food. This is a displaced Palestinian mother in Gaza City.
What I'm doing now is trying to separate rice from bulgur and stones. As you can see, we're forced to eat stones because there is no flour, no food, no water. Nothing reaches us, not even aid. As you can see, I'm sorting this just to silence my children's hunger. The kids are crying all the time from hunger. This is bird feed. It's not fit for human consumption, but we cook it to quiet the children's cries.
On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu outlined plans for a stepped-up offensive on Gaza, saying the Palestinian population, quote, will be moved for its own protection, unquote. Netanyahu did not say how much of Gaza Israel plans to seize. Reuters reports that could include all of Gaza's territory. On Monday, Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, spoke at a conference of Israeli settlers.
We are finally going to conquer the Gaza Strip. We are no longer afraid of the word occupation. We are conquering Gaza, clearing it out, and taking control of every area we enter.
Earlier today, senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan told Dropsite News the group won't re-enter ceasefire talks while Israel continues its deadly assault on Gaza. Hamdan also said Hamas would only disarm if Israel ends its assault and allows for the creation of an independent Palestinian state. Human rights workers have revealed the identity of the Israeli officer directly responsible for the killing of 5-year-old Palestinian Hind Rajab, along with five of her family members and two rescue workers who were attempting to reach them during an attack on Gaza City in January of last year. A war crimes complaint filed by the Hind Rajab Foundation at the International Criminal Court seeks the arrest of Lieutenant Colonel Benny Aharon, commander of the Israeli Defense Forces 401st Armored Brigade. The foundation filed the complaint May 3rd, which would have been Hind's seventh birthday. In Washington state, police arrested some 30 student activists overnight after they occupied the University of Washington's engineering building to protest their school's ties with weapons maker Boeing. The group Students United for Palestinian Equality and Return are demanding, quote, that our tuition money and our research not be used to fund and fuel genocide, they said. In Pennsylvania, 9 people were violently arrested Saturday at Swarthmore College as police disbanded a Gaza Solidarity encampment that had been named the Hossam Shabbat Liberated Zone in honor of the 23-year-old Palestinian journalist killed by Israel in March. Students are demanding Swarthmore, quote, divest from Israeli occupation, aggression, and apartheid and declare itself a sanctuary campus, unquote. In Michigan, Attorney General Dana Nessel on Monday dismissed charges against 7 Gaza Solidarity protesters at the University of Michigan's encampment. The Guardian newspaper last year exposed Nessel's close personal, financial, and political ties to the University of Michigan's Board of Regents, which had been calling for prosecution of campus protesters. This is Amir Maklet, the student's attorney.
This was not about trespass. This was not about felony conduct. This was the criminalization of free speech, and today the state of Michigan agrees that you still have the right to speak up. But today, we want to remember that this is not the end. There are still students across the country that are facing this persecution. There's still a genocide that is happening in Palestine. And we should never forget that today we still get to stand firm and say, free Palestine!
In other campus news, UCLA student protesters who were attacked last year by a pro-Israel mob under the watchful eye of police officers have filed another lawsuit, this time against the state of California. The lawsuit details excessive violence deployed by LAPD officers towards the peaceful demonstrators who were hit by some 50 rounds of rubber-coated bullets, causing serious injuries. California law prohibits police from using rubber bullets except in extraordinary circumstances. And in a victory for the campus protest movement, the University of San Francisco has announced it's divesting from four U.S. companies that have contracts with the Israeli military following a sustained campaign by students. Here in New York, dozens of Columbia University faculty and staff dressed in black walked in a procession and stood outside their campus Monday to call for the release of the abducted Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil and others who've been targeted for speaking out for Palestinian rights. Coordinated vigils were also held at Tufts and Georgetown, where scholars Rumeysa Ozturk and Badr Khansouri were also recently abducted by ICE. The joint action across the three universities will be held weekly. This is Columbia Classics professor Joe Howley speaking after Monday's protest.
We were standing vigil on our campus today at the same time as groups of faculty standing vigil at Tufts University, Georgetown University, Boston University, all of us coming together on our different campuses to bear witness to the detention of our community members, to the fact that students and faculty are being made into political prisoners in this country simply for speaking out on behalf of the Palestinian cause.
In New Jersey, passengers have been experiencing long flight delays and scores of daily cancellations at Newark Airport for well over a week amid staffing shortages, thick cloud cover, and ongoing construction. The chaos started last Monday after air traffic controllers lost both radar and radio communication with airplanes for 90 seconds due to a technical problem at the Federal Aviation Administration facility in Philadelphia, which has been experiencing outages. The incident led to the controllers taking trauma leave to recover from the stress. United Airlines has canceled 35 round-trip flights out of Newark Airport per day, citing customer safety concerns and calling out the FAA for failing to keep its air traffic control system updated. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has called for an inspector general to investigate the chaos at Newark. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has found Customs and Border Protection agents who fatally beat Mexican father Anastasio Hernandez Rojas are responsible for torture. It's the first time the independent commission, which investigates extrajudicial killings and human rights violations, has issued such findings against a U.S. law enforcement agency. In 2010, Rojas was crossing the southern border in an attempt to return to San Diego, where he'd lived for 25 years to reunite with his wife and five children after being deported. He was stopped by border agents who brutally beat and tasered him while he was handcuffed, until Rojas died of heart failure. His death was later ruled a homicide. The commission's findings come nearly a decade since his family filed a complaint in 2016. At the time, Democracy Now! Spoke with international human rights lawyer Roxana Altholz, who represented Rojas's wife, Maria Puga, and his family in the case.
Not a single agent in all of U.S. Border Patrol history has ever been held accountable for one of these killings, has ever been disciplined for one of these killings. As far as we know, all the agents responsible for Anastasio's death are still on active duty. They have never been disciplined, much less held criminally accountable for the killing.
In more immigration news, the Trump administration said Monday it would pay undocumented immigrants $1,000 each if they voluntarily leave the U.S. and return to their home countries. Rights groups have slammed the move as coercion, since immigrants are being threatened with detention unless they choose to self-deport. In Western New York, advocates are demanding the release of a group of labor leaders and members of the United Farm Workers who were taken by Immigration and Customs Enforcement during a raid Friday. At least 14 workers at Lynette and Sons Farms were arrested that day and are now being jailed at an ICE facility in the city of Batavia. ICE agents reportedly had a list of names taking the workers in unmarked vans. Meanwhile, Trump officials are in talks with several African nations, including Rwanda, Angola, and Equatorial Guinea, to accept immigrants who are deported from the United States. The Trump administration's already made similar agreements with some Latin American countries, including El Salvador, where hundreds of Venezuelans were sent and imprisoned at a notorious mega prison in March. Several explosions have rocked Port Sudan, the Red Sea city where hundreds of thousands of displaced people have sought refuge from Sudan's civil war. Witnesses blame drones launched by Rapid Support Forces paramilitaries, or RSF, for the latest attacks. On Monday, the International Court of Justice dismissed a genocide case brought by Sudan's military rulers who accuse the United Arab Emirates of backing the RSF by supplying arms, including drones. ICJ justices said they lack jurisdiction to try the case. Canada's newly elected Prime Minister Mark Carney has arrived in Washington, D.C. for talks with President Trump at the White House today. It's the first face-to-face meeting between Trump and a Canadian leader since Trump imposed steep tariffs on Canada and called for the U.S. to annex it as the 51st state. Ahead of Carney's visit, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said he's skeptical of cutting a trade deal with Canada.
Been basically feeding off of us for decades upon decades upon decades, right? They have their socialist regime, and it's basically feeding off of America.
In Utica, New York, a corrections officer has pleaded guilty to manslaughter in the fatal beating of 43-year-old Robert Brooks, who is incarcerated at the Marcy Correctional Facility. Body camera footage of the December killing shows the group of guards repeatedly punching and killing Brooks in the face, kicking Brooks in the face, chest, and groin. Four of the officers involved were wearing body cameras but did not activate them. Brooks was black. All the officers who took turns beating him appear to be white. Six guards were charged with murder. Christopher Walroth is the first to take a plea deal. He'll be sentenced in August. And this year's Pulitzer Prizes have been announced. Reuters won the Investigative Reporting Pulitzer for its expose of the lax regulations that help fuel the fentanyl trade. Congratulations to former Democracy Now! Producer Laura Gottesdiener, one of the Reuters reporters who won the award. And renowned Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary for his, quote, essays on the physical and emotional carnage in Gaza that combine deep reporting with the intimacy of memoir to convey the Palestinian experience of more than a year and a half of war with Israel, unquote. At least 31 of Abu Toha's family members were killed by Israel in Gaza. He'll be joining us later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, crypto researcher Molly White on Trump's newest grift, building a cryptocurrency empire while destroying its regulators. Stay with us.
Extended greeting, a connecting glance. Life is just a jaded game to them.
They will give it a chance.
But you know, and I know, that the galaxies are all around us. And life will flow as long as the grass grows and the water runs. Freedom is free. You can't take that away from me.
Chicano Batman in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Senators Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Merkley are calling for a federal investigation into the Trump family's cryptocurrency venture after a fund backed by Abu Dhabi announced it would make a $2 billion investment in crypto exchange Binance using a Trump-branded crypto coin. The deal could generate hundreds of millions of dollars for the Trump family. In their letter, Senators Warren and Merkley wrote, quote, "The deal, if completed, would represent a staggering conflict of interest, one that may violate the Constitution and open our government to a startling degree of foreign influence and the potential for a quid pro quo that could endanger national security," unquote. Senator Warren also released this video last week blasting the deal.
"The United States is getting ready to bless Donald Trump's latest grift. A shady Abu Dhabi investment firm just announced it's going to make a $2 billion business deal with a foreign crypto company called Binance. So here's the kicker. Binance and the foreign investment firm are going to use Donald Trump's stablecoin to finance their transaction, essentially giving Trump a cut of that $2 billion deal. Boy, looks like corruption, smells like corruption. So yeah, the Senate is going to put a stop to it, right? Wrong. Right now, the Senate is getting ready to greenlight the grift by passing the so-called Genius Act next week. This is a bill that would make it even easier for the president and his family to profit off their own stablecoin and oversee their own financial company."
President Trump is headed to the Gulf next week. In related news, last night on Monday, President Trump spoke at a crypto and AI innovators dinner to raise money for a pro-Trump super PAC. Tickets were $1.5 million a plate. The event was held at the President's Golf Club in Virginia. The co-host of the dinner was David Sacks, the White House AI and crypto czar. Sacks is a South African-born tech investor who is part of the so-called PayPal mafia, founding PayPal with Elon Musk and Peter Thiel. On May 22nd, Trump is also hosting a private gala dinner for the top 220 investors in his meme coin. The dinner will also be held at the Trump National Golf Club. The promotion also offers an ultra-exclusive VIP reception with the president and a tour of the White House for the top 25 Trump meme coin investors. The anti-corruption group CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, called the promotion, quote, "one of the most blatant and appalling instances of selling access to the presidency we've ever seen," they said. We're joined now by Molly White, an independent cryptocurrency researcher who runs the Citation Needed newsletter. She recently wrote an article headlined "Trump's Newest Grift: Building a Cryptocurrency Empire While Destroying Its Regulators." Molly, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can start off, for folks who aren't following cryptocurrency that carefully, explain what cryptocurrency is.
Cryptocurrency is a digital asset, so it's an entirely digital form of speculation, essentially, that allows people to speculate on the value of tokens that are, you know, things like Bitcoin or Ethereum. And it's entirely digital. There is no physical representation. There is no physical asset or service backing the tokens.
And in your recent piece, Molly, you wrote that the scope of the Trump family's cryptocurrency conflicts illustrates a degree of corruption that makes the emoluments concerns of Trump's first term seem quaint by comparison. Could you explain?
Yeah, so Trump's crypto ventures are growing seemingly by the week. It seems like every week something new is announced, whether it's his World Liberty Financial crypto platform or his Trump meme coin or rumors of a new crypto game that his backers are working on. And so he is really allowing for bribery and the types of corruption that we've never seen in the American presidency. He's allowing people to send him money. He is profiting directly from the cryptocurrency industry while he is simultaneously influencing policy, legislation, calling off regulators who previously oversaw the crypto industry in ways that are benefiting him and his family very directly.
And given the fact that cryptocurrency has become sort of the favored money laundering method of criminals, drug dealers, anybody who wants to hide their money, what is the impact of the growing size of the crypto industry in terms of the financial system?
Well, it's definitely concerning. I mean, there is this major potential for criminal activity using cryptocurrencies. We've seen it dramatically increase for use in money laundering, as you mentioned, terrorist financing. Ransomware is primarily these days done with cryptocurrency. And there's very little in the way of regulations or laws that crack down on that type of activity. And under the Trump administration, we've actually seen what few regulations were in place be pared back. The Securities and Exchange Commission, which previously was essentially the primary regulator of the cryptocurrency industry, has been called off the beat. We've seen cases against cryptocurrency companies dismissed with prejudice, investigations of crypto companies dropped. We've seen the cryptocurrency investigations teams at the SEC and the Department of Justice dismantled. And so under the Trump administration, I think we are seeing dramatic expansion of the potential for criminal activity within cryptocurrency, as well as the, you know, complete reduction in consumer protections that would allow those who choose to get involved with cryptocurrency to do so without the fear that they are going to be scammed or taken advantage of.
Molly, how exactly does Trump and his family profit from these crypto ventures? How much money are we talking about? And explain, Trump has a crypto coin, Melania has one. Explain how this works.
Well, Trump has multiple crypto ventures that are directly enriching him. So you mentioned there's the Trump meme coin, which is the token that is themed after him, essentially, and is being currently used as a ticket to this private dinner at his golf course. Melania has a token of her own. And the Trumps make money off of those tokens, both in terms of the trading that's happening as well as facilitating the liquidity for those types of tokens. Then there's the World Liberty Financial platform, which is a yet to be released crypto platform that is nevertheless selling these World Liberty Financial tokens to interested buyers. Trump makes 75% of the protocol revenues from that project, and he owns a 60% stake in the company. He and his family sort of maintained the illusion that there was an arm's length relationship between the project, despite it being entirely themed after Trump. Prior to his election and inauguration, but after he was inaugurated, they sort of gave up that facade and obtained a majority stake in the company. And then Trump has sort of an endless list of additional crypto ventures. He has his NFT projects. He has sold crypto-themed sneakers. You know, there has been reporting that he is working on a crypto game. His Trump Media and Technology Group, which is the company that is behind the Truth Social platform that he controls, is also getting into crypto with a partnership with Crypto.com to launch crypto ETFs, exchange-traded funds. And there is also reporting that they are considering launching their own token. So the list really goes on. And so far, I think he has raised close to $1 billion, or he has profited in close to $1 billion from his combined ventures. That number is only continuing to increase as there are deals like this stablecoin being used by the United Arab Emirates Investment Fund. And as, you know, multiple new ventures are being launched as we go on.
And of course, the Trump administration has claimed that all of Trump's investments are in a blind trust, that basically his sons run the company, not him.
Right. That is the claim. Although he's made varying claims, he's even claimed not to profit from crypto at all, which is plainly untrue. But I think that, you know, frankly, it is not fair to say that he is divested from crypto ventures when it is controlled by his sons. His sons are profiting, and ultimately he is profiting. You know, he should not be making policy decisions or influencing policy in ways that benefit his family, quite plainly. And I don't think that the claims that he has divested are accurate whatsoever.
Molly White, can you talk about the latest push by the Senate Democrats? Tell us more about the legislation that they want to change on cryptocurrency pending in Congress. What did the so-called Genius Act, a bill backed by the crypto industry, call for?
So the Genius Act is primarily intended to regulate stablecoins, which are a category of crypto assets that are intended to maintain a peg to some other form of asset. So we often see dollar stablecoins, which are crypto tokens that are intended to be worth $1 a piece. Those are assets like USDC or Trump's USD1 stablecoin, which was recently launched. And the Genius Act, you know, seeks to install some amount of legislation that would regulate those types of assets. And this is something that we've seen the crypto industry pushing for quite some time, even prior to the Trump administration. But Trump's own crypto ventures, including launching his own stablecoin, have recently stalled that legislation, with a number of Senate Democrats speaking up to oppose this bill, as well as those in the House, signaling that, you know, the Trump family financial interests are a major concern for them. The crypto industry has also pushed for a number of changes to this bill that would benefit the industry. And we're now starting to see Democrats in Congress saying that this bill does not go far enough to prevent national security concerns or even terrorist financing using these stablecoins, which have been used to transfer massive amounts of funds. They are sort of the bedrock of the crypto industry, almost like the poker chips at the casino. Stablecoins are a major venue through which value is transferred in the crypto world. And so this type of legislation is extremely important to get right.
Do we have any sense of who in the United States does this investing in crypto coins? How widespread is it? Or is there a profile of typical people who are buying the coins?
Well, there are everyday people who are involved in crypto speculation, but we also see major venture capital firms and investment firms getting involved in the crypto world as well, including a number that have a significant presence in Washington. Andreessen Horowitz, for example, is one of the largest technology venture capital firms. They have significant investments in the cryptocurrency world, and a number of Andreessen Horowitz employees have been installed in various positions at the White House. Mark Andreessen himself was involved in selecting members of the Trump administration, and they were very heavily involved in political campaigning. Then there are figures like David Sacks, who is the AI and crypto czar at the White House. He runs an investment firm that also has crypto investments, that some of which he's not divested from. So there are, you know, multiple profiles of crypto investors, many of them institutional, but also everyday people who have, you know, bought the story that cryptocurrency is a way to get ahead financially, that crypto investments can potentially provide high returns and are worth the enormous risk and volatility that crypto brings with it. And, you know, now the enormous risk of fraud and collapse throughout the crypto industry as well.
Molly White, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Software engineer, independent cryptocurrency researcher, running the Citation Needed newsletter. We'll link to your recent piece, Trump's Newest Grift, Building a Cryptocurrency Empire While Destroying Its Regulators. Coming up, the Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha. He left Gaza December 2023. He came to Syracuse University. On Monday, he won a Pulitzer Prize. Stay with us.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome one day. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome one day. And we'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. Every faith and
Roger Waters performing We Shall Overcome in our studio, accompanied by Alexander Roatan on cello. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israeli strikes on Gaza have killed at least 11 Palestinians so far today, with deadly attacks reported in Khan Yunis and Beit Lahia in Gaza City. The attacks follow Israeli attacks that killed 54 Palestinians Monday. Health officials in Gaza say at least 57 Palestinians have already starved to death. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, reported some 66,000 children in Gaza are suffering severe malnutrition due to Israel's total blockade of food and aid now in its ninth week. Some Palestinians have resorted to eating turtle meat, grass, rotten or expired food. One displaced grandmother, Muhammad al-Talalka, said it took her 5 hours of standing in a line at a community kitchen in Gaza's Nusayrat district to get one meal to feed her hungry children and grandchildren.
I've been coming here since 8 a.m. to the Tikuya soup kitchen for food to alleviate our hunger and be able to stand up. We are suffering from famine, real famine. I have not eaten anything since this morning. I cannot speak because of hunger.
On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu outlined plans for the stepped-up offensive on Gaza, saying the Palestinian population, quote, will be moved for its own protection. He says the whole population must move south. Netanyahu did not say how much of Gaza Israel plans to seize. Reuters reports it could include all of Gaza's territory. We're joined now by the acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha. On Monday, he won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary for his writings in the New Yorker magazine. He was praised for his, quote, essays on the physical and emotional carnage in Gaza that combine deep reporting with the intimacy of memoir to convey the Palestinian experience of more than a year and a half of war with Israel, unquote. At least 31 of Mossab's family members have been killed by Israel in Gaza. His books include Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza, and forest of noise. First, Mossab, it's terrible to say in light of what's happening in Gaza to start off by saying congratulations, but wow, you just won the Pulitzer Prize. Talk about what this means to you and the statement you put out as you learned of this huge honor.
First of all, I would like to thank you, Amy. Appreciate your work. Appreciate Democracy Now. Thank you so much for your voice. This honor has brought to me tears and joy. Joy because this is... this is a big prize. This is something that every writer, writer and artist and journalist, dreams of winning. But this is also very sad for me because the pieces for which I won the prize, the four pieces. I mean, I wrote about seven or eight pieces for the New Yorker. This prize was awarded to four of my pieces. The four pieces are one about an article that I wrote about starvation in Gaza. The other one was about the difficulty of traveling as a Palestinian. The third one was about the loss of the refugee camp. And the fourth was about the Gaza we leave behind. And unfortunately, as I'm looking at the titles of these essays, the situation in Gaza is worsening. I mean, not day after day, but minute after minute. And people are dying. I mean, children are dying of hunger. People are dying for lack of not only food but also medicine. So this prize means a lot to me, but it also reminds me that there is a lot to work on, not only by writing but also encouraging people who have the power to take action to stop all of this.
And Mossab, I wanted to ask you, given the fact of the continuing attacks of the Israelis in Gaza and all the complete failure of the world community to be able to do anything to stop Israel, your sense of what you're seeing in terms of the American public since you've been in the United States in terms of its response to the war?
I think the American public and also people around the world are eager to learn. Unfortunately, the mainstream media is not doing enough. Israel has been preventing people from visiting Gaza, not only after October 7th, but even before, but especially after October 7th. Journalists, medics, a little number of doctors have been allowed to go to Gaza. I think the American people need to hear more and more voices. I mean, my voice is only one voice that is necessary to hear. But there are so many other voices that are there still in Gaza, journalists and writers and artists and university professors who have so many stories to tell. My story is one story. My story is other people's story. But we need to hear more and more people. And I think that the American public is truly eager, and not only eager, but I mean, they feel the necessity, they feel the duty to hear and learn about more and more stories in Gaza. And I'm happy that my four pieces that won these awards are stories that I wrote about myself, about my people in Gaza, about the refugee camp where I was born. My family members were killed. My students, my great aunt, whose body is still under the rubble until today, since last October. So there are so many other stories that are to be heard, and I hope that the American magazines and newspapers and the American channels, the news channels, would open up their spaces to let these writers and people in Gaza share their stories, because this is what we should be doing. At least, I mean, killing people in Gaza is one crime, but also not giving them the space to talk about their pain and also demands, because all the time we hear, politicians. Yesterday we hear President Trump saying that we want to help the people of Gaza. They have to move. We will feed them. But I mean, come on. I mean, we are not people who need to be fed. We are not hungry because we don't have food. We are hungry because we are under occupation. We are under siege. We are under genocide. This is not what people in Gaza want. It's not that they want only to eat. They want freedom. This is what they want.
Masab Abu Toha, I want to turn to you speaking at the Jewish Voice for Peace national meeting this weekend. You read If I Must Die by the great Palestinian poet killed in Rafah, Rifat al-Arir.
If I Must Die by Rifat al-Arir. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze, and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, see the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope, let it be a tale.
If I must die. Masab Abu Toha, you reference Rifat in winning the Pulitzer Prize yesterday. Talk about your relationship with him, who he was, and what he means for the people of Palestine.
Yeah, I talked a lot about Rifat. I wrote about him. Rifat was a university professor who was murdered. And this is not mentioned a lot. He was not only murdered alone. He was murdered along with two of his siblings and four nephews. Rifat died while he was holding a pen in his hand, while he was wearing his glasses, reading poetry and writing more poems to us, asking us to continue his message, which is the tale of every people in who are oppressed by occupation, who are under siege, who are dying in a genocide. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale. If he must die, we need to tell Rifat's tale. We need to, as I said before, if I must die, this is a crime for someone to die, to be killed by occupation. And we have to remember here that 70% of the population in Gaza are refugees. So these refugees, they have stories. It's not that they were killed by an occupation. No, they were killed as they have dreamed all their lives to return to their homeland. So Rifat died with two of his siblings and four nephews. And in the past, he lost another brother in 2014. So Rifat was not only a writer, he was not only a university professor, but he was also a mentor for so many young writers. He introduced me to the We Are Not Numbers project in 2014 after the Israeli 51-day attacks on Gaza, which claimed the lives of three close friends of mine, about whom I wrote in my poetry and in my essays. So Rifat was more than, it is a huge loss. And this is why we have to honor his memory by continuing to tell the tales. Not only, and when Rifat said, let it be a tale, it's not only Rifat's tale, because Rifat's tale, my tale, my grandparents' tale, are the tales of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. And our tales are not only Palestinian tales. It is a human tale of loss after loss after loss, while the world is watching us. So we refuse to die just like that. We will fight to live. Not only to live, but also to tell the stories of those who died before us, who were meant to die in blindness, to die in darkness. No, we will live, we will fight, we will continue to speak up. Because this loss, the loss of Rifat and so many hundreds of my friends and family members should not be a waste. We should tell the stories of these people because we don't want to lose more people. When we write a poem, it's not because we feel pain for those who we lost, but we are trying to stir people into action when they feel what we are feeling.
And Mossab, you have been telling the stories of what has been going on there through your poetry and writing. But even in the United States, it has not been easy. The right wing groups have called for deporting you, and President Trump is cracking down on non citizens critical of Israel. Talk about the problems you've had even being able to speak at many universities.
I mean, this is the tragedy of being a Palestinian or being a pro-Palestinian human rights. You are not safe living in Palestine. For example, in my case, in Gaza, I was wounded at the age of 16 in an airstrike that killed 7 people. I lost 3 close friends of mine in 2014. I was abducted by the Israeli forces in November 2023. I lost my house, which is my family house, in October 2023. Two of my brothers-in-law were abducted by the Israeli forces, and we don't know anything about them. So, and I lost so many members of my family, as I said. And I survived, by the way, airstrikes. I mean, airstrikes that were just 2 houses away from me, in Jabalia camp or in Beit Lahia. So it is, I mean, to live in Gaza is very dangerous. So I didn't feel safe living in Gaza. And now when I'm traveling outside of Gaza, not only in the United States, I don't feel safe because, I mean, we are not usually welcome anywhere. It's not only in the United States, but it's most of the world. And now when we come to the United States, you know, to raise our families and to share the stories of people who we lost. I mean, I'm not talking about another people. So this is what is different about me as Mossab. I'm not talking about other people. I'm talking about myself. I'm talking about my siblings, about my parents, about my grandparents. I'm talking about the graves of my grandparents who I will never find because Israel destroyed cemeteries. I will not take my grandchildren and show them the kindergarten which I attended, not my university from where I graduated in Gaza. I mean, to come here and speak about these things is not even welcome. So what should I do as Palestinian? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I mean, this world doesn't make sense. In Gaza, you will get killed, wounded, or abducted. When you go out and try to speak about these things, you are being chased by these hate groups, these extremist groups. So what do they want from me? And when they talk about deportation, I mean, someone would deport someone to their homeland. But my homeland is occupied. I wish I could go back to Gaza. But before you deport me back to Gaza, I need to be in Gaza where Palestine is free. I can't go back to a country that is not only under occupation, but that is undergoing genocide. So I would love to go back to Gaza. It is not my biggest dream to live in the United States. My biggest dream is to live in my free homeland, in Palestine, to be able to visit the original home city and live in the original home city of my grandparents, Yaffa, which is also the name of my 8-year-old daughter. This is where I would like to be deported. I would like to go back and live in a free Palestine.
Mossab, I want to thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us. I'm so sorry also that you had to cancel your tour all over the country. You apologized to people at all the universities where you were going to be speaking, saying how much you looked forward to sharing a forest of noise with them. I want to congratulate you on your son's birthday this weekend as you were at Jewish Voice for Peace speaking and reading your poetry. And also ask if at Syracuse University, where you are now, if they'll be holding a big celebration. You are now a Pulitzer Prize winner, as was announced yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I'm looking forward to celebrate, but as you understand, it is not easy for me to celebrate anything. I mean, during the some of the events, people would be dancing on music. I mean, I do not feel fine, you know, celebrating something. The only celebration is for me is when there is an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza and also in the West Bank, and when justice and peace are served in Palestine. This is the only reason for me to celebrate. But I can't celebrate while I'm. Well, I know that my sisters, my brothers and my parents in Gaza are starving. You know, I'm sending them this good news, telling them that This is my hope, that my voice would reach more and more people who have the power to intervene and stop this suffering. I can't just dance or eat, you know, cake or just, you know, I mean, it is not normal for me. But what is good about this is that this recognition, I hope, would prove to be a step towards greater understanding, and would stir people in power to take action to put an end. Because I don't want to continue writing essays and poems about these painful memories and these painful realities.
Masab Abu Toha, thank you so much. Palestinian poet and author. On Monday, he won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary for his essays published in the New York.